Hey everybody, Brian McClanahan here. Are you looking for a great website that gives you history the way it was intended to be told, with no PC, no Marxism, no progressivism? Well, I've got it for you. It's learntruehistory.com. That's learntruehistory.com. Learn history from great professors who don't sugarcoat it for you. This is not for your delicate flowers. That's learntruehistory.com. learntruehistory.com. This is the Brian McClanahan Show.
3, 2, 1, 0, liftoff.
Welcome back to the Brian McClanahan Show. This is episode 55. Glad to be back on the program with you. I just want to remind you, if you like this podcast, please share it around. Please like me on Facebook and follow me on Twitter and YouTube and all the social media. I'd appreciate your support. The only way we're going to continue to get the word out is for the good people like you to go out there and make that happen by sharing this stuff around on social media. So I would be honored if you would do that for me. I can do some of it myself, but growing an audience requires a little bit of word of mouth as well. So please get out there and pound the pavement, so to speak, and let people know you like the Brian McClanahan Show. I also had a fan the other day contact me and say that one of his daughters met me at a conference I attended, and the other daughter didn't. So I'd like to tell the other daughter, I think that one was Elizabeth, hello. So this is so now you've met me through the podcast. So thanks for listening, and again, please. Please spread the word. So today I'm going to talk about an issue I think that's in the forefront of the news, and it has to do with Donald Trump and his immigration executive orders. So there's two different ways I could look at doing this particular issue. I could do it tackling the issue of executive orders, or I could do it also looking at the issue of immigration. And so I decided to do immigration first. At some point I'm going to talk about executive orders. But, of course, I did a lot of that in my 9 Presidents Who Screwed Up America and 4 Who Tried to Save Her. So I'd rather do the immigration issue first. I think that this is something that is the issue of the 21st century in many ways, moving forward, and how we're going to wrestle with large numbers of people coming into the United States and how to do it constitutionally, one thing, and also how to fight back against some of these leftist charges that are hurled against the administration and against the people who believe in immigration reform. Now, trying to curtail immigration to the United States is nothing new, as I'll talk about historically. This has gone on really since there was a United States. So first, let's tackle one of the falsehoods of American history, and that is we're a quote-unquote nation of immigrants. So first, let's take this into pieces. So we're gonna look at the first part. The United States is a nation. Well, this is simply not true. It never has been true. Now, even the founding generation used this language at times, you know, a nation, an American people. There were people who did that. But overall, that particular idea was rejected over and over and over again in the founding generation. So the United States is not a nation. It's a union of states. It's a federal republic. And in those states, you had, even at the beginning, the founding, you had 13 individual republics. And certain parts of the United States had similar attributes in terms of culture. So if you look at states like Massachusetts, Connecticut, and New Hampshire, all three of those particular states had a general culture that was completely alien in many ways to the culture of the other regions of British North America. Rhode Island was also similar, but and Maine, I mean, eventually Maine becomes a state in 1820, but their culture was even a little different than that of Massachusetts. Rhode Island would not have been formed unless Roger Williams had been booted out of Massachusetts and excommunicated, and then petitioned to form his own colony. And so people in Rhode Island and people in Maine, Maine was founded by John Wheelwright, who was also the founder of New Hampshire, but he was booted out of New Hampshire because he and John Winthrop did not get along. So those two particular states are a little different. Rhode Island's always been very independent. In fact, it was the last state to ratify the Constitution, and they didn't send any delegates to the Philadelphia Convention of 1787. So, but you generally had a political culture and an overall culture in Massachusetts. Massachusetts was the hub of New England. That was drastically different from that which you would find just even a little bit further south. So you had one particular region there, a Puritan culture. And then you go a little south into New York. And New York was founded by the Dutch first. And so that particular culture of New York, all along the Hudson River, the patroon ships that were there, it was very much different from what you would find in Puritan Massachusetts. In terms of religion, it might have been a little more similar than what you would have in the South in particular, the Dutch being Protestants. But you would find that these patroons were much more like Southerners, at least in the way that they wanted to handle their social and economic affairs. These patroons were patroon ships were large estates all along the Hudson River, and essentially, if you were a patroon, you were the master of your own domain, meaning that you basically set every rule you could for your particular estate. There was the law of the manor, essentially, on these patroon ships. So New York was different from Massachusetts. Now, Massachusetts did have a fairly strong commitment to local constitutions. You could have variations within the towns in Massachusetts compared to the overall legal authority of Massachusetts. But still, you had different cultures in New York and in Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island, New Hampshire. This is actually why, you know, New York, when you get to the 1860s, there was some discussion, primarily because of economics, about New York City seceding from New York State. And having an independent New York City because they were being harmed by the war. You know, the southern states had long been propping up, in many ways, the New York City economy through shipping and the trade of cotton. So there was this definite difference between New York City and the rest of New York, and also New York and the rest of New England, I should say. And of course, Vermont breaks free of New York and secedes and forms its own state because Vermont was different from the rest of New York. So you have these cultural clashes going on. In order to have a nation is a people with a similar language, religion, cultural background. You could say that they all had the same language. They didn't all share the same religion, though, and definitely didn't have all the same political culture or even culture in many other ways. Even when it comes to language, they all spoke English, but it was a different kind of English in every region of British North America. So we never had a nation. If you look at the rest of the Mid-Atlantic states, you look at Pennsylvania, the Quakers dominated Pennsylvania, and Quakers were heavily persecuted by Puritans. There was no way the Quakers and the Puritans had really ever seen eye to eye on just about anything. The Quakers were much more dedicated to civil liberty than the rest of the Puritans. They shared a little more in common with the Cavaliers and the Celts in that regard than they did with the Puritans. But the Quakers were highly different from the Puritans, and they, of course, dominated Pennsylvania, also Delaware for a time, and even parts of New Jersey. Even though New Jersey, after it became part of the British Empire after the Peace of Breda in 1664, New Jersey developed in some ways like the Carolinas. They had a constitution very similar to the Carolinas. So even New Jersey, which was part of this Quaker sphere of influence, but you had in New Jersey, even into the 1860s, a very strong strain of agrarians, people that believed in a much more southern style of government. And so New Jersey was even a little different. And then as you move into the southern colonies, you know, Maryland, Virginia, the Carolinas, Georgia, you see the dominance of the Cavalier culture, which was the dominant culture of southern England You know, places like London. In fact, you know, look at their language. Words like ain't. That was a word that came out of Southern England at one point, not New England, but Old England, Southern England. And the Southern dialect was very much found in places of Southern England, even into the 19th and 20th centuries. These cultures, these regions were different. There was no nation there. Political culture was different. Their customs and manners were different. And so it was very hard. No one really talked about putting together a nation in reality, because everyone knew, as Benjamin Franklin recognized in 1754, that all the colonies were too provincial. Jefferson saw them as independent countries when he authored the Declaration. He saw it before that. Even in the time leading up to the American War for Independence, he saw that these areas were different. And so a union was made much more sense, a union of states, a federal republic, because putting a nation together would have been impossible. You have to have a common culture to do that, and no one thought we had that in the 18th century or the 17th century in British North America. So what about, are all these people immigrants? Well, absolutely not. I mean, of course, you can say that the first people here, the first people that arrived here, first Europeans, were settling here, and they had not been here before. But by the time we get to the 18th century and the formation of the United States, a lot of the people who were doing that were fourth generation, third generation Americans. It's like saying today that if you're born here and your family's been here for several generations, you're somehow an immigrant. You're not. This is your native home. And so to kind of give you a perspective on this, what we call, for example, what we know as the English people today, would they be immigrants? Well, if you look at the history of England, I mean, the first people there were Celts. And those Celts were then essentially conquered by the Roman Britons. So those Celts would be the native Britons. But the Roman Britons came in and took over. And then, of course, after the Roman Britons, you had the Angles and the Saxons, Germanic raids into England. And nowadays, we think of the English people as the Anglo-Saxon people. But these Anglo-Saxon people weren't there. They were Germans smashing in from the continent of Europe. But are they immigrants? No. They are the dominant culture, at least somewhat. Because eventually, the Angles and the Saxons were conquered by the Normans. And also, the Danes were in parts of the British Isles. You know, you had the Dane Law, and you had the red-haired Irish were not native to Ireland. They're the Danish peoples who came in and smashed into Ireland. So are they immigrants somehow? Are the Normans immigrants? The Normans, of course, who conquered England in 1066. So all of these things led to a political culture, but we would not say these people are all immigrants. And this is the trend all throughout history. You know, what we call the Greek people, well, we say they're immigrants because eventually the people that we know as Greeks, that was part of what was called the Dorian invasion at one time. So, I mean, are all these people immigrants? Absolutely not. But somehow we get stuck on this idea, well, we're all immigrants here in America. No, we've got most people now that are involved in government, and this has long been the case in America, have been here for several generations, so they're not immigrants. I wouldn't classify myself as an immigrant. Of course, you know, I can say, well, my ancestors came from different parts of Europe, whether it's the British Isles, which is where they were predominantly from, or Northern Europe. I do have, you know, Norman blood in me, you know, or other parts of Central Europe. But still, I mean, I am thoroughly an American, and this is where I was born. My family's been here for generation upon generation upon generation. Even though I could say, well, I mean, I have ties and blood ties back to the old world, I don't fit there. That's not my culture. So to say that we're a nation of immigrants, number one, we're not a nation, and number two, this is false, completely false. Even if you could say, well, then quote unquote Native Americans, which are, you know, the American Indians, were immigrants as well, because human remains, you know, in terms of what we found with archaeological digs, everyone came here from somewhere else, even them. I mean, they were coming from other parts of the world into the Americas. So this is simply just a leftist falsehood to try to get people to think, well, I mean, we got to support unlimited immigration. No, we don't. It's a narrative that's completely out of step with American history, particularly when you look at the political culture of the United States and the political culture of the states. Some of this has been, recently been foisted on us by the Hamilton farce, right? So you've got this smash hit Hamilton, which, I mentioned in my book, forthcoming book, How Alexander Hamilton Screwed Up America. And the left has just embraced Alexander Hamilton. He's one of them because he's an immigrant. See, he comes here, and if you listen to the music, here comes Alexander Hamilton, this great immigrant. He's going to change everything. In some ways, Hamilton was different there. You know, Hamilton was an American nationalist because he never really had a state that was his home. He didn't have any roots like Jefferson did or Washington did or even the Adams did. He was a recent arrival when you get to the 18th century. But when you look at Jefferson and Washington and Madison and in the South and the Adams in the North, or people like Roger Sherman in the North, I mean, these are people that have been here for a long period of time and had developed attachments to their community that went beyond simply this amorphous United States, this American nationalism. Now, some of the times, you had people like John Marshall, who was also attached to Virginia long term, but yet he became an American nationalist. His identity was to America, not to Virginia. But I think overall, if you look at the founding generation, more of them were attached to their region or their state than they were, or their local community, than they were to some amorphous United States. So this idea that we're a nation of immigrants is just completely false. Now, I did tackle this a little bit in my Politically Incorrect Guide to the Founding Fathers. And so I thought that was written in 2009, though. So here we are 8 years later. And this myth still persists. Of course, I never was believed so much in my work that people would read it and say, oh, yes, it's conclusively proven now we're not a nation and we're not a nation of immigrants. But I hope that at least that persuaded some people, and maybe this podcast can do the same. So we've got this idea that we've nation of immigrants. We should not believe in that, and how this factors into immigration. No region, no throughout history, no people have ever been able to maintain themselves when you have a situation of unlimited immigration. It's never been done. In fact, and I did the podcast "We Are Rome." If you look at the history of Rome, essentially the reason the Roman Empire fell apart was because of open borders and unlimited immigration into the Roman Empire. It eventually was a catastrophe because they could not maintain their traditional political culture. And I think that's what this comes down to more than anything else. You have to, if you're going to have immigrants into your region, they have to assimilate. They have to assimilate at least with your political culture. And I would say there is, in some ways, maybe not as much anymore, but for a long time there was a common political culture in America. And that was a dedication to federalism and a limited central authority. Now, that has changed over time, particularly with the progressive movement. And the progressives are the ones who are really driving this nation of immigrants narrative. And it doesn't matter if they're on the left or the right. In fact, that the progressives need this kind of thing to make their system work. But that has not been the case throughout American history, and I think the American dedication to federalism was fairly strong, particularly in the 18th century, both North and South, because they saw it as a way to protect their own political culture, their own regional culture. Federalism worked because it allowed them to innovate within their states and do in their states what they wanted to do. Nobody in Connecticut wanted Virginia running Connecticut or South Carolina running Connecticut, and vice versa. Nobody in Virginia or South Carolina wanted Connecticut running their state. So this dedication to federalism worked for the political culture of those regions and also the overall culture of those regions. And if you can't assimilate people, then you run into problems because these people are going to change your political culture. So this is why when you look at immigration, why it becomes very important to push an assimilation message. And really, people talk about the heyday of the American Empire, which would be the 1950s. and into the 60s. Well, if you look at that time, immigration was stifled in those periods. You had some time for America to develop kind of this American nationalism that people liked. I mean, it was rah-rah America. We were great. We were the big boy on the block. We're beating everybody up. And people kind of like that. You know, we're the number one. We're number one. You know, you think about that. Our team is number one. And so you didn't have mass immigration, really, in the 1930s and 40s and 50s. The Great Depression stifled a lot of interest in coming to North America from other parts of the world. If you look at immigration numbers, you know, the charts of immigration, you had very little immigration into the United States in the 1930s and 40s. It started ticking up again in the 50s, but it wasn't until some immigration reform in the 60s that you started seeing immigration start to spike again, and that's because the left controlled Congress, and they were able to ram through several immigration reform efforts in the 60s, from the 60s through the 80s, and now we've seen an explosion in immigration. And of course, the left has been driving the narrative. But this, you know, the political culture of America in the 30s and 40s and 50s was much different than the political culture of America in the 60s and 70s and 80s and into the 21st century. So we've had this explosion in immigration. Now, the question is, what can the federal government do about it? Now, of course, Trump has issued his executive orders, and people are all going ballistic over this. And, you know, this is problematic. He's being a dictator, et cetera. There's all these conspiracy theories out there. The left is going crazy about, you know, executive overreach, whereas for 8 years, they didn't really care about their guy with executive overreach. In fact, that was the entire point of 9 presidents who screwed up America. This has been an issue since 1789. The creation of the executive branch was a major disaster for American liberty and, of course, the Federal Republic, because ultimately, even things that Washington was doing, of course, Hamilton's whispering in his ear and making these things happen, ultimately, some of the things Washington did set the stage for some of the things that Andrew Jackson did and that Abraham Lincoln did, and then all the progressive presidents of the 20th century into the 21st century. I make the argument in that book that we've had, essentially, since 1989, an elected king. I know George H.W. Bush was just as bad when it came to executive abuse as Bill Clinton or George W. Bush or Barack Obama, now Donald Trump. So my hope and I knew going in that Donald Trump was going to abuse power. It's going to happen because the executive branch has been set up that way now for, when you look at over time, we've had, 28 years of executive abuse since 1989, and now we're just going to have, 29 years. We're going to have another 4 years of this. And so the left is so inconsistent. What we need to do is get together and say, you know what, we don't want this happening to either group. We don't want the president to be able to abuse power at all. Now, can the president direct immigration policy? Well, if the Congress passes legislation to that effect, then he's going to do it. My argument would be, and going back to, say, Jefferson, and if you look back at the founding generation, my argument would be the states have always been able to regulate immigration outside of the purview of the federal government. They've always been able to do this constitutionally. And Jefferson made this case, I think, fairly strongly in the Kentucky Resolutions of 1798. He pointed that out. The states have always been able to regulate, and constitutionally the only power that can really regulate who's within their borders. So the United States government can pass laws of naturalization, universal laws of naturalization. That's to become an American citizen. And they did so in 1790. In fact, it was fairly easy to be a citizen as long as you're of white and good moral character. That was actually the requirements. But the states could regulate immigration into their own borders. And Jefferson made this fairly clear, as I said, in 1798. And I'm going to read you part of the Kentucky Resolutions that make this very, very, very clear. So Jefferson said in the second section of these 1798 resolutions that the Constitution of the United States, having delegated to Congress a power to punish treason, counterfeiting the securities and current coin of the U.S., piracies and felonies committed on the high seas, and offenses against the law of nations, and no other crimes whatsoever. Those are the only things the United States government could punish according to the Constitution. Those are the only laws they could pass that would actually have some type of punitive effect. If people violated these laws, Congress could do something about that. But otherwise, they cannot punish any other crimes. Those are the only crimes enumerated in the Constitution that Congress has authority over. That's it. And so he uses a Tenth Amendment argument here because he says any other powers are not delegated to the government by the Constitution. So they can't do anything else. And he says in the fourth section, resolved that alien friends are under the jurisdiction and protection of the laws of the state wherein they are. So this gets into the idea of sanctuary cities. Trump cannot force state authorities and local authorities to enforce his immigration laws, or his immigration edicts, I should say. He can't do it. The Supreme Court has even said that, and you can't use funds to coerce a state. So in that particular way, Trump can make all the wishes that he wants, but these sanctuary cities, they have the law on their side. Now, there's going to be some battle between these cities and the state. The state can actually force the cities to do things because the cities are creations of the state. But this gets down to the idea, I think we should even decentralize further. The state should have much more, cities should have much more autonomy than they do. But the states are the sovereign power, and the cities are mere corporations of the state. So you do have this argument. The states could actually coerce the cities to do something. But alien friends, as Jefferson calls them, are under the jurisdiction of the states and the laws therein. And so the states can actually limit immigration if they choose. They can say these people can become citizens and these people cannot, according to the original Constitution. This is an argument Jefferson would have made. If the state of Massachusetts doesn't want to admit people in their border and say that you're an illegal alien here, they can do that. And they can say you're no longer welcome here. You have to leave the state. So the states could actually regulate immigration into their states. And they don't have to take refugees from the general government. They can tell the general government, no, I guess you're going to have to keep them on federal property. The general government could say, we're going to put them on a military base in your state, but they couldn't go anywhere else. They would have to stay on the base. So as long as they're on federal property, I guess they could say, well, you can stay here. So the states can actually limit this. They can limit immigration if they want to. And the cities can too. So this is actually Jefferson's argument. I think the state should actually take a stand here. And states that don't want immigrants, states like Texas or Arizona or New Mexico, whatever states are, in my state of Alabama, there was an attempt to limit immigration into the state of Alabama, and it actually worked. So the states can do this. The general government needs to get out of the way. When you look at airports, the states can actually regulate airports. They're within airports are not federal property. So, states can actually regulate who can come in and out of their own airports if they want to. They can make security much stricter than it is in their airports. This is not all under the guidelines of the federal government. We tend to look at the federal government for too many things, and the states could do all of this stuff. So when you look at this immigration issue, number one, I think that limiting immigration is essential because you want people to assimilate. But number two, the states could do more than they do. And they should. Everyone should not just look to the general government to say, hey, general government, bail us out here. We've got a problem with immigration. Do something about it. The state should say, you know what? We're going to do something about it. We're going to restrict immigration. We're going to do things to ensure that the political culture and the overall culture of our region fosters a climate of assimilation. You have to believe in our political culture. Now, it doesn't mean that you have to drop everything. I mean, we like this idea. We can go out to a Mexican restaurant. We can go to a Vietnamese restaurant or a Chinese restaurant or a Thai restaurant. We like these things. We like to have diversity in our food choices, for example. We like to look at and learn about different peoples from different parts of the world, and that's great. I mean, I think people should do that. People should be worldly in that way. But what we also need to insist upon is that people who come here try to assimilate with our political culture and the culture of the region wherein they live. That needs to happen. Because if they don't, then you create a situation where further down the road, your political culture and the culture of your people can be eroded. And I think that's problematic. So we should be insisting on assimilation. We should be insisting on people become Americans. And they should not just that, but become Americans within the culture where they reside. And over time, you see that it does happen, but it does take some time. And so limiting immigration allows assimilation to happen, allows people to be absorbed into the culture of the time. If you just dump, and the founding generation said this. Look, George Washington said it very clearly. He was very much against people being dumped, a large number of people being dumped into an area, because that would destroy the culture of the region. They could not be assimilated. Washington even made that very clear. I'm fine with people coming in small numbers, and over time trickle in, because that allowed them to be assimilated. And essentially that's what happened in the North American colonies. You didn't have large amounts of people being dumped in at every one time. People came in and they assimilated to the culture that was here. So that's the key to all of this. You can't just have a large group of people, you know, thousands of people dump into an area. It's going to completely change that area. And so we shouldn't want that. We should want welcome people in who are going to assimilate. We're going to teach them how to be good Americans. We're going to teach them about the political culture and the regional culture wherein they reside. And they're going to assimilate with that culture. And that was generally the idea of American immigration all throughout the early 19th century. You even had pushback against this. You had the Native American or Know Nothing Party, who were very much against immigration. You had, you've always had people who were pushing for federal rules against immigration. The 20th century, you know, you had pretty strict rules, quotas, and other things, literacy tests, and all kinds of things to keep certain people out of the United States. And so I think that this idea that we've always just opened the doors and let everyone in, this is a creation of the last 50 years. It's a falsehood. It's a fabrication that's never jived with history. Americans have always been interested in limited immigration and assimilation up until really you get to the late 20th century. That's when the narrative began to change, and that's because the left controlled everything, and they simply spewed falsehoods. I mean, this is what it comes down to. So we're not a nation of immigrants. We're not a nation at all. We're a union of federal republic, a union of federative states. That's what we are. No American nation exists. There is a political culture that needs to be maintained, and there are regional cultures that we try to maintain as well. And by allowing too many people in to dump in at one time, that's going to change that. So I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Brian McClanahan Show. I'll see you next time. Thanks a lot.